gave me some kind of cigar, and I sat and smoked. And I met Rick, and we went into a bookstore, and I was stumbling around like I was totally smashed. Here. Anna said, play with the cigar. All he said was, I think you'll like it. Anna said, these things, I'm not kidding, these things messed me up for hours. It was great. They're hard, and they taste weird. It's interesting, Michael gave me a cigar and recommends it. It figures it's completely nuts. I mean, he says, I think you'll like it.
The evil Mr. McLaughlin.
I promise him I'd break something for him this weekend. Well, I burned something, so that was he'd be happy about what I burned. It's a ritual. I steal beer glasses for him and break stuff. Sometimes I break things and he steals the beer. He stole me this one. You saw the beer glasses he stole me. This long, beautiful 20-ounce glass. I stole a mailbox for him. Had it confiscated by the South Carolina police.
You stole a mailbox, right?
It got confiscated? Well, kind of.
I didn't get arrested.
Well, Saturday,
later in that same night, me and a friend of his, also named Michael, were pissing on humane statues at the University of South Carolina, Kansas. He was mad at it.
It's got no face. It's got no message. It's just a fucking statue. Let's steal it.
It weighs 20 tons there, sir.
Let's piss on it.
All right, I'm glad. I like being near when the crimes are committed.
Yeah, it was very strange.
Vandals. Wait, you stole milk crate from where?
In New Haven.
Was it the 80 night? I can't believe it. Okay, I got the night. I don't know from where. Come on, that was like 1,000 years ago. You had a better memory of the picture. What was it, from a bar?
No, it's from a bar. We were walking down the street, this grocery store, or something. And there were like people like watching us, and they're like talking to us. And then one guy said, they're like,
Then her boyfriend came back and he was getting scared. He didn't know whether to like leave alone or not.
We went in the pancake house. Now, standing in near the entrance.
People go waffling at 3 in the morning. That's right, those hips go waffling at 3 in the morning.
In the south.
In the south.
Standing near the entrance were these two Godzilla-sized South Carolina state troopers.
Michael was paranoid about walking to the pancake house with the mailbox in the door.
What
was
he doing?
So what he did was he put it near the entrance in a little shadow. I said, Mike, it's not going to be there when we get back. And it wasn't.
Mike was like a wobbling.
The funny thing is that the troopers came into the place and there were these two like 16-year-old girls sitting there. They were nice looking. They were 17. I don't know. They're sitting there eating, and these two troopers sidle on up and sit down with them, have a nice conversation. And we're trying to figure out what the hell was going on there.
Something wailing, South Carolina.
I heard something about the swamp.
Something wailing, South Carolina.
Then we came out. Me, Michael, and these two other people, Barbara, the poetry girl, and this other Mark, who's just as crazy. We came out, and there's a car, and there's a young woman's curled up in the back. We gazed at this car for a long time. She was curled up sleeping. The same thought went through all three of our minds, like, can we jumpstart the car and jump to the swamp? There's a hill nearby, can we do it and roll this? I think he's hearing some other story in his mind that's far funnier than that. Okay, what the fuck? We'll just start and see what happens. Fuck it all. We're gonna start with Yoshi. We're gonna start with the chowder story. Because I need to be cheered up. I'm bummed out about the drunken Polish people. They don't want to go to the Mayans. I want to celebrate them all.
Right, you should not be bummed out.
I know, you're right, and I'm trying to like get to that other side.
What you should realize is we have a communal list of
That's right.
Communal alcohol experience.
That's right. The Dionysian.
And it's like multinational aspects. You have the American and the Polish and the and the birthday.
I want Dionysian Clitorian ecstasy.
I mean, everybody should come together over me.
Okay, here we go. Presenting for your listening pleasure, the mellow tones of Yoshi Mishi Aoki. Now, Jim, you demanded this one.
Maybe three and pretty strong.
There we go, there.
Stories which have been interpreted are now as one as well. Coordinating clinical comes out every Friday at Pancakes Cafe. Most of the music cards. June 28th, 1995. Writing at Pancakes Cafe in BC. It is 12:30 p.m. now. Surprisingly, child is pouring. Every time, child becomes bitter and bitter. But sometimes, I want to have something else for a while. So, child once in a while is a good idea. Because I'm the happiest man that I've been with child.
I was neglecting you guys for a chance.
Who's winning?
I just won.
All this cost 1994. Today is from Saturday at 6 p.m. Saturday's best friend, he was pulled up in. I just prefer doing that if this recipe for myself. I need to know the recipe, so I don't need to worry about missing it. No, can't is not a real chowder. It's just a sushi. Real chowder means that it is made traditional way. on Saturday. It's 10:15 a.m. I am eating crab chowder at 6. Crab chowder may kill me. It's good. I'm going to die for it. If I'm asked to choose my women crab chowder, then it's hard to say. Because I love them both. Even though I don't trust some women, I love other women than them. I will go to crab chowder. Which is better? I don't know. I cannot ask anyone about this question because nobody really knows which is the better choice. So if I am asked to choose between chowder and curry, I would choose curry for good. But if I am asked to choose between chowder and my other women friends in them, well, then it's hard to say because they like me to know me and I like them. So this question must be reviewed over and over.
I love you, man.
They hugged. We at least found a Rosie's and Tumen shook hands and started hitting each other 5 seconds later. But maybe not.
Yesterday was August 24th, 1995. Today is not a chowder day, so handshakes have it. Therefore, I am eating now. It is 08 a.m. now. I am living in heaven. September 14th, 1995. It's Thursday. Eat crumb chowder instead of Friday lunch because I must leave to New York tomorrow at noon or 1 p.m. so that there is no time to stay for lunch at Handshakes Cafe. From September 15th, 1995 to September 28th, 1995, I have not been ridden for some reason. If you have questions about why I did not write them, well, ignore the questions, it's not your business. October 20th, 1995, ate crab chowder at Handshakes Cafe. Fighting people in New England make chowder. I love it. August 27th, 1995. Eating chowder as is my normal routine. Who knows anything more luxurious than eating chowder here?
Yay!
Yay.
back on my business. You look at all the tin cans, that there's got to be another way.
Really? Did they just stand on the floor?
Yeah, we were kidding, so. Ray, look.
I think that we're going to begin tonight's meeting, or continue this weekend's meeting, or something like that, with a joint presentation by me and Yoshi. Well, like last night when you started out, though we never got anywhere further than that, I just thought it would be like the Twin Towers, you know? So come over here.
Well, because I'm bigger than
you. Okay. Now, after the last meeting, I got this idea for a kind of a presentation that Yoshi and I could do together. And when we got back from the last weekend down here that we had, he and I, without going home first, we went right to the Boston University Library, and I said, why don't we get some Japanese poetry? And so we went, and we spent like a couple of hours there looking at Japanese poetry. And my idea basically was to find a book that would have the Japanese for Yoshi to read, so you could all hear it in the original. And then I would read in English, so you could know what it means. So a book of that kind was found. And we're going to read about 10 poems. This is a book called Introduction to Japanese Court Poetry. I guess the Japanese... what was Japanese court poetry, Yoshi?
I don't know.
You know? Well, I have the impression from this book that there were poets who were court poets to the Japanese emperors, and there was a long tradition of poetry written for the kings and queens and, you know, and all that. And so anyway, I picked out some poems, and Yoshi is going to read them in the Japanese, and then I'm going to read the translation.
It was not so much written for the nobles as it was written by the nobles themselves.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they, because poetry was, you know, because mostly it was nobles who were literate, poetry was kind of like an avocation for them when they were not attending to their kingly or queenly or emperorly duties.
Well, there you go. Did you know that? Well, now you do.
And there was poetry. The poetry written by the women was mostly love poetry, and the poetry written by the men tended to be more towards more stately subjects.
War.
Yeah.
Yeah, the men wrote war poems and the women wrote love poems.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's sort of a random selection that covers, I don't know, a couple of millennia skipping around of Japanese poetry. Let's see. The first one is most appropriate. Can you hand me that beer? Does everybody have a drink? Because this first poem honors liquor. And you don't have a drink, Yoshi. Get that man a drink. There you go. Yeah. Now this poem was written, I don't know, you know, 1,000 years ago or something. But we've all been honoring alcohol for, I guess, as a human race for, you know, centuries.
Millennia.
So anyway, okay, so here we go. Okay. The next, this is the guy I was trying to tell. Hitomaro.
Okay.
Some, like the Shakespeare of Japanese poetry or something. Japanese court poetry. Big guy gets his own chapter.
Okay,
now why don't we do this? This is in stanzas. Why don't you read your two lines and I'll read that. We'll go back to four.
Okay. Tsuno Sahau. Uwami no ume no.
It was by the sea of Uwami, where the clinging ivy creeps across the rocks.
Kotosaeku, Kara no saki naru.
By the waters off Cape Kara, a land remote as the speech of far Cathay.
Ikuri nizo, umiru ou.
Yes, there where the seaweed grows, clinging to rocks fathoms beneath the waves.
Arisonizo, tamano wa ou, tamamo nasu, nabikines Nariki Nesi Ho.
And where on the stony strand the seaweed glows like polished gems. My young wife dwells there, who like seaweed bent to the current of love. The girl who slept beside me, soft and lissome as the gem-like water plants. Now those nights seem few when we held each other close in sleep. We parted unwillingly, clinging to each other like ivy creepers. My heart ached and swelled against the ribs that would hold it. And when my yearning drew me to pause, look back, and see her once again,
O fune no watari no yama no momijiba no chiri no magai ni imo gasane saya ni mo mietsu.
Waving her sleeves in farewell, they were already taken from my sight, hidden by the leaves, falling like a curtain in their yellow whirl, at the crest of Mount Watari, a crest like a wave that waves that bears a ship away.
Tsumagomoru Yakami no yama no kumoma yori watarau tsuki no.
Although I longed for her as for the voyaging moon when it glides into a rift of clouds that swallow it up on Mount Yakami, where
Oshike no mo waku kakuro i Kureba Amatsutau Irihi Sashinure.
They say men retire with their wives. I took my lonely way watching the sun coursing through the sky till it sank behind the mountains.
Wasurao to omoeru ware mo shikitae no koromo no soze wa torite nurenu.
Though I always thought myself a man with a warrior's heart, I found that my sleeves, white as they were like our bedclothes, were all soaked through with tears.
Aogama no agaki no hayami kumoi ni to imo ga atari o sujite kini.
My gray-white horse has carried me at so swift a pace that I have left behind the place where my beloved dwells beneath the cloudland of the distant sky.
Akiyama ni otsuru momijiba otsuru momijiba shimashiku wa na chirimagai so.
Oh, you yellow leaves that whirl upon the mountain slopes, if only for a moment, do not whirl down in such confusion that I may see where my beloved dwells.
That was a long one. Seems like quite long.
Okay, Jim, the umbrella title for the story is Voices Music for the Cosmic Ruin, and this section of it is called Everything Under the Sun is in Tune. October 95.
Everything under the sun is in tune.
Which is powerful thing to say.
Powerful thing to say.
That's the title of this section.
I do a little thing, but I wish I could do this. I can't imagine doing this. Well,
just take that title and do what you want.
Thank you.
civilization.
Thank you, Jim. Let me hobble back to your seat now. Have you ever had an Anisette cigar there, Bobby?
No, I have had some, clove.
I've heard of clove cigarettes.
This thing hasn't soaked.
I lit it and I held it up and the end stayed on fire.
That was funny.
It was a very nice smell, even when you're not smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah, ozone. This stuff had it for yeah. Keep it burning, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Keep burning, yeah. That's
here we go. First time I smoked one of those, I got stoned. It was the same thing. I was walking through a bookstore and I was seeing little figures.
You're on about four cords.
I'm
afraid you're going to get up and for some reason.
Okay.
See, like, a skull. Dark enough for that.
I guess you know more than I do. Mr. Doesn't Smoke.
I didn't smoke dozen.
You didn't smoke that?
I smoke probably 3 dozen.
Let's go now.
A puck. And 3 cigars, that's it.
Okay. Are we out of the Bex there, dude?
Yeah.
No, there's some in the refrigerator.
Oh, well, it's far away. So you get me a Budweiser? See, something to wet my whistle.
take a
oh, okay. Wait a minute. Jerry's offering something that's far darker.
It's much more
tangy. Barman here.
Alright. He's a well-prepared drinker.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for that.
Okay.
Okay. So this story is called Voices Music for the Cosmic Ruin, a new fiction. This is part two of that story, for the second section. Everything Under the Sun is in Tune, October 95. Section one. Somewhere along the way, I began to burn up, shift uncertainly, let loose some of the prime lights in my sky, let them go elsewhere, float gently and obscurely away from me, did not stop their drift elsewhere, did not bark loudly and frantically as what I loved, much of it, diminished from view, tugged off by weak winds that a single blow from my hand could have obliterated. The shoreline marking the boundary between my mere isle of soul and the brightly large ocean of world began to change. Simple foulness, ugly, thick, and cutting, arrived, a wave at a time, until all seemed changed and not seemed retrievable. Well, whatever coherent thought I managed to summon on this topic is effaced by the next face I encounter. The train leaving late chugs up to speed and arrives 5 minutes early, while the on-time one breaks down halfway and must be towed to its destination. And yet, a shoreline can be cleaned, can it not? The source of its pollution, perhaps a sewage pipe pumping pollution into a harbor miles away, can be closed. Nature may repair and renew. Hope resides firmly in the belief that the soul's shoreline, too, may be endowed with reprieve. Change will be noted, of course, but ever on, as ever before, the sun will rise and its strange aspect, its shape like a black pen, will remain true. Blonde hair and sky, full curves approach and retreat. While it filled thins till it contains naught but a stain in its fabric marked pay now or else. Gods nimbly arrive in violet flames and shimmer numbingly through the prostate back of prayer, but peaceful open eyes retain no elevating revelation nor confirmation of the odd and sacred occurrence by a sequel visit. Pens full, however often they empty, fill again. Hearts are they, emptying, filling, emptying again, till we take for a given their strange reliableness, till we are withered by a day, the pens do not rise, till they do once more, till we are so experienced with emending darkness, which does not end, that we know, that I know, that my ease will ever be just after dawn, and my tension will be just after dusk. Section 2. Richard James Americus had been awake for a few moments, but had not yet opened his eyes. Almost afraid he to learn whose breasts were they against which his face lay. Soft. Like the cream he'd been drowning in just before his dream collapsed. Soft. Breasts. Never had a woman he'd ever met understood what they meant to a man. How they were quite possibly the one part of a full-grown woman which never lied. They responded to sensation, to touch. Unloosed from silk or cotton shackles, they were irrefutably revealed. More, as much as they participated in pleasure, in desire, so they participated in life. A woman's pride or shame, a man's need, an infant's hunger. They were good, even altered, cut or swelled falsely. They were good. So, whose were these? These that just shifted a bit till Americus' mouth was grazed by a hard nipple. Think, bastard, what happened last night? Think. She sang to you in the darkness. She undid her buttons one by one. Her body released, she bloomed in the dark air. You spent the night as one. 3. But all this explains nothing. 'Tis necessary to return to mid-fall of 1994. To Rebecca's 14th birthday in the night, you went to Berlin before the fall to look for her while she was at Lunatee's Cafe awaiting you. You missed each other that night, and this is what happened. How did this misunderstanding occur? Hard to say. Well, maybe not so hard. You decided to surprise her by going to the Arcadia Bookstore and Cafe to fetch her rather than awaiting her at Lunatee's Cafe, deciding that carrying her by motorcycle would be the right thing to do. Be better, of course, if you were escorting her to Lunatee's Cafe to see your old man's band play like countless Friday nights before. Oh well. The bookstore was on a busy street in the city's Bohemian district. You park on a side street nearby. Nice bike, man, calls a bedraggled hippie in a doorway nearby. Long stringy hair, shags a dirty green woolen hat, unshaven, several shirts on and a dirty pair of jeans, ragged sneakers. Thanks, you say, knowing what's coming. Hey, you got a couple of spare bucks? I need a pack of cigs bad. You walk over to him and make a motion to sit. He straightens up and looks just a little scared as your 6'6 frame joins him on the step. You like my bike? Man, it's fine. You think it's safe sitting over there? Well, that's uncertain. I can use a pair of guarding eyes. You up to it? If I give you enough for cigs and maybe a couple of pops at the bar when I get back? Sure thing, man. You fold a 20 into his hand. He's still scared. Are you sure you'll wait? Hey, man, listen. I may not look like much, but I've been around. I never had a bike, but I once had this fine bet, and man, did I cry when it was totaled. I'll do it for you, sure. Thanks. No sweat. That done, you enter the bookshop dressed in leather and denim. A young woman is behind the counter, but not your daughter. Looks about 19, 20 maybe. She's singing. For a moment, you're so struck by her lovely mien that you don't hear the guitar her voice is accompanying. Her eyes are shut. Her blonde hair is fragile and long, and strands of it weave crisscross through it. Her red blouse is full. No silk or cotton can obscure what resides there. What man wouldn't grow hungry? Her lower figure is shrouded by a long skirt, flowery pattern of red and black. Her mouth opens and closes, and you watch curved lips briefly reveal pink tongue and white teeth. You imagine her in your band singing prettily as that. You imagine her in your lap, and this image is much more adorable. The song has ended as she's looking at you curiously, saying something, smiling. When did she vacate your lap? 4. Your friend Christopher Standard, he crouched on a little stool behind the counter. He of mustache and soft gray button-down sweater, playing guitar, helps out your silence. Richard, how are you? The soft tones of his familiar voice ease your freeze. You look at him and grope for words. Hi, Chris. Is Rebecca around? The blonde apparition's face blooms in smile. Oh, are you her dad? You nod. She's such a sweetheart. I've only known her a week or so, but already it seems like she's my little sister. Annoyed for no damn good reason, you say softly, I've known her for 10 years, and it seems like she's my daughter. The girl does not feel this slap. She's smiling at you still. I think she might be upstairs, Rich. Her shift is done, says Chris. She shouldn't even been here today, says the girl, her voice revealing a drawl none native to New England would possess. It's her birthday. We wouldn't have let her work much, just kept her sitting there with those art books she loves so much. You decide to be nice to this girl, but as you are opening your mouth and hoping something genial comes out, she is turning away. I should sell some of those books, Kristoff. Don Jack didn't hire me for my creaky voice. Chris smiles, having relinquished neither his seat nor his guitar's ready pose. Fine, Franny. I'll guard the register. She sweeps a stack of books into her arms and is quickly lost among the stacks. You poor sucker. Already you're wondering what Franny tastes like and whether her moans drawl out too. Chris retrieves your attention. Care to play, Rich? You shake your head. I have a birthday to celebrate. He nods, starting to strum again. 5. The only way to reach the Arcadia Cafe is to exit the bookstore and go around the corner of the building to its brown door entrance. A flight of stairs up to a landing, whose sole occupant is a chalkboard, which says, Kill the rich and let God sort it out. A shorter flight of steps and another landing. On the right, a closed door. Directly ahead, an open one. Do you know what I'm describing, Jim?
Sounds like that.
No. It's describing Grand Central Station. Oh, okay. Garage, the same thing.
So it's got more than 4 hours.
Yeah. Well, you just check it out. This is sort of a portrait of Grand Central Station.
The garage
ago.
Was actually the word I was searching for.
Yeah. There's a shed with floors on it.
Yeah.
Ignoring inclination, you pass through the open door and into a series of rooms laid out like an apartment, but not really furnished like one. For a moment you stand in the first room seeing nobody, noticing the dartboard on the wall looking off-blade, and the diminutive brown tables with pairs of chairs each. 'Tis a nice room, one to sit and chat in or spend a free morning reading the newspaper, or even take a few tossed swipes at that dartboard. Hi, are you here for the party? It hasn't started yet. You're early, but that's okay, speaks up a woman whose scrutinizing glance somehow tells that she's paused before ending your reverie. Is Rebecca around, you say, quietly, trying politeness? This is what college was like. All these damn young women distracting by their very presence. This one's about the same age as the blonde one in the bookstore. On the heavy side, long dark hair, a mosh of loose clothes and lightly but carefully applied makeup. Her demeanor is friendly, perhaps thought you were a teacher at the college nearby. Rebecca? Oh, you mean the little girl? The painter? I don't know. She's here sometimes. She works at the bookstore. Did you check there? You nod, growing impatient. Nervously, the woman mumbles about someone or other in the smoking room who may know, and you follow, your question posed to more bohemian folk. They're friendly, though. Offer you a smoke. This is where Rebecca goes. So this is it. You try to absorb it, her presence here, its residual effect. They all know her, express a like affection for her preciousness and her talent. Suddenly the bearded one, eyeglassed, head wrapped in a shiny red kerchief, motions above you, above where you sit on a square pinkish Persian cushion, the room small and shut off by a door. he says, "Look above you. That's some of her work. Is that your band?" Right there on the wall is a watercolor of noisy children in concert. Its figures are dashed splashes, its colors are dark and dim, near somber. "Do you paint too?" asks the heavy brunette as she passes you a stick of Camel Unfiltered to replace the one you just snubbed out on the ashtray. You shake your head. Not a stroke. "Your wife? Her mother?" This girl is pressing now. Briefly you imagine her naked, happy and appreciative. Briefly. You shake your head. Rise to depart. "I have to go. I'll find her, I'm sure. Thanks." The several gathered nod and smile. You open the door, and there stands Franny. She smiles at you. You freeze. "Oh, are you leaving?" she says, genuinely disappointed. You nod. She motions to look beyond you. "No kin, then." You shake your head. Her smile deepens, takes on dimension and purpose. "Can I walk you to your car? I know it sounds silly, but that child has built you up into a statue in the sky. But she says you don't like it around here much." She's accompanying you to your car your motorcycle, that is, chattering on. Your final defense is to ignore it. All these nervous words and light laughs, all these damnable pressings across your border. The bike impresses her. Her brown coat shrouds her loveliness and her hair is loosely tied back. Her brothers race. Her brothers don't like touring bikes, say they're slow. She likes them, she thinks. She's never been on one. You mumble this and that. This isn't fair. Isn't a conversation. Is crowding and diverting you. Get on the fucking bike. Put on your helmet. Don't look at her legs, her hair, or her chest. Smile unfocused and then turn on the engine. She's asking you a question. What? Whatever. Yes. Yes, honey. I can't hear you. I have to go. What? Yes, fine. She climbs on the bike behind you. What? She presses forward and wraps her arms around you. What? I have to go. What? Fine. What was that question again? Was it, can I mold my lovely form against your back? Was it, can I wrap my arms around you and then when we're going about 80 miles an hour down the highway, a long stretch, can I get my lovely fingers in your pants and give your hard cock a good pull or two? Was it, can I invade your life, drink your best, cause you to bellow out ferocious songs of love, till reality bursts through the door at dawn and finds you alone and puking dirges into the toilet of a microphone? What? Yes, fine. What was the question again?
Hey, this is the partial review.
Partial or Herschel?
Yeah. Of a book called Photorealism. About the photorealism, which started in the early 70s, in which the artists would, the technique that was typically used was they project the image directly from the photograph onto the canvas or paper or whatever
they were using.
Huh?
Like when they're black.
No, what they would do is they would take a slide, a photograph of of a street scene or whatever. It's not like brilliant stuff.
No, this stuff was quite dry. We did not like lights.
Yeah. Well, the photorealist movement in art is they try to, as closely possible, recreate a scene from a photograph, only doing it with paint.
Right.
And the effects would, usually a lot of them would do street scenes and shit like that. Not a lot of human figures. Few of them did, but not a lot. And the statistics on the book go something like this: 368 pages. It has 1120 illustrations and 560 color plates. And the color plates are very good. First, this must be said. Mr. Mizell, the author, is a snap. Not a terrible snap, mind you. Which brings to those who love contemporary art as priceless. But he is a snap, nevertheless. The main reason I make this contention is because he would like to limit the scope of this movement, Wood Realism, to 16 artists. No more, no less. Out of the goodness of his heart, Mr. Maisel includes other artists whose work quote, stylistically similar to photorealism, in many cases indistinguishable. But alas, they will never be part of the elite 16 that constitute the movement. But as I said, if, as I said, you looked at Mr. Maisel's prefatory notes, after looking at the pictures, you'd be hard-pressed to figure out why Richard McLean's pretty but absolutely thoughtless horse pictures, fit for nothing but cheap insurance calendars, are included. But then Jacob's industrial landscapes, which fit in far better thematically with the rest of the movement, are not. Maisel's thoughts may sound quite convincing, pictures, but they do not fit the art. But this is an opening quibble about an ambitious book. A book that is the second in a series with photorealism attempts to exhaustively chronicle a movement from the start. Simply put, Maisel succeeds in his ambition. Working with the 16 featured artists, he has accomplished getting illustrations of the majority of the works they have produced from 1980 to the publication of the book in 1993. Those not included are exhaustively cataloged. Maisel may have made photorealism one of the most documented movements in art history. Photorealism in history. Part of the reason Maisel may be too quick to circumscribe photorealism is the ephemeral nature of the art from the latter half of the 19th century to the present. Impressionism distorted form slightly and eliminated detail. Jackson Pollock eliminated form entirely with his monstrosities masquerading as art. I don't know Jackson Pollock. But I think that from the Impressionist time to photorealism's advent, I believe that a meta-movement can be decided, can be defined. Form elimination art. Photorealism may be best described as the return of realism with a vengeance. Not simply bringing back fullness and forms of the human figure and nature, but turning an uncensoring eye to the second creation, the landscape we've made. Photorealism is the most influential form of art and the culture, affecting everything from album covers, CD boxes, to magazines, to Zippy the Pinhead. Photorealism, I believe, defies the trend of mini movements and remains the benchmark of a new movement, the form concerned. The artist, John Bader. John Bader's style varies from one painting to the next. His subject choice does not. He paints diners. In White Diamond, 1982, the photorealistic style is done to perfection. The way light reflects across the bumps and bends in the aluminum is absolutely true. Whereas in Red Robin Diner, 1982, and Tip Top Diner, some colors are more muted. There's some flatness, particularly in the corporate logos. In general, a more painted quality. I do not believe this is either accidental or a deficiency in style. Think of diners in their heyday, the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. Then look at photos of magazines from the same era. They all have this feel, which Bader knows intimately. Bader will haunt you. Richard Bechtel. Bechtel's territory are the long rows of condos and tract houses, ubiquitous in the Sacramento, Oakland area, where he paints. He paints the upscale, the low scale, the adobe, the aluminum. He paints the people on cement patios with the hose laying on the lawn. But with Vincente Avenue intersection in 1989, he makes a breakthrough. It is less linear than earlier works, and he also integrates weather into the end in a more interesting fashion. There are dark clouds over one side of the avenue. There is an unmatched tension which is not equal to that before or since. Charles Bell. Bell does for toys what Ray Lichtenstein does for comic books, taking them out of the closet and onto the canvas. They're wonderful studies in reflective light, in particular the way he deals with the polish of gumballs, the glass of marbles, the steel of old roller skates and pinballs. The fact that these pictures are such fun, be the a perfect way to convince an uninterested kid that he wouldn't die of boredom in an art museum. Adults, meanwhile, appreciating the playfulness used with classical subjects as The Judgment of Paris and Midsummer's Dream, both from 1986. Technically, Bell's the best of all, and a certain relief from some of the snotty attitudes reflected in other artists in this film. There you go.
Okay. All right, it's a work in progress.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Thank you. That's good, Mark. That's good. That's some sharp art criticism. That's
about the marketing
review. It's a book review of an art movement.